The best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Coming up, at Yellowstone National Park, about 5,000 migratory bison roam and graze the grasslands. New research shows that these bison are helping the environment with their grazing habits. This means that there are potential benefits to restoring bison to an ecosystem. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds, in for Lucas Willard. Would you want to run into a bison in the wild? I would assume your answer is no. Well, tens of millions of years ago, bison once traveled all across North America, grazing on forests, grasslands, and plains from Nevada, reaching all the way to the Atlantic coast. With the near extinction of migratory bison in the 1800s, it has been almost impossible to study the role they played in their ecosystem. At Yellowstone National Park, about 5,000 migratory bison inhabit the protected land. A new study offers a look into the critical role that the bison once played in restoring ecosystems and could if their population is restored. I spoke with Bill Hamilton, professor of biology at Washington and Lee University, to learn more.
So they're a large herbivore. So they eat plants only, and they are traditionally grazers. So they primarily eat grasses and other things that show up. Forbs, or they're a head-down consumer. But they're ruminants, so they actually have the ability to break down cellulose. They have the rumen, which is a big bioreactor chamber that ferments and breaks down the cellulose by propagating microbes, fungi, bacteria, and prokaryotes, and then it enters into the true stomach. So they're able to get a lot of energy out of relatively low quality food, particularly in the winter when they're eating dead grass, and they're very good at doing that. They range anywhere from 1,000 to 2,200 pounds for cows to bulls. They have about the same gestation as humans, 9 months. The rut takes place in late July, early August, and then calves are born late April, early May. Their nickname is Red Dogs because they have a very reddish color, and I haven't found a convincing reason why they're colored that way, but by this point in the year, they've turned their kind of standard brownish color. They put on a winter coat. They tolerate extremely cold temperatures, and they tend to put their head into the snow and the wind in the winter and kind of take it head on. So they're really quite tough animals. They used to range all the way across North America. There were approximately 30 million bison ranging from, up in Canada along the Rockies all the way down to the Georgia, to the Alleghenies and the Appalachian Trail. We had them here in Lexington, Virginia, or in the Shenandoah Valley for sure. And then they ranged all the way down into the Texas-Mexico border. So really large range that was reduced in the late 1800s with westward expansion. But early on with the settlement of the East Coast with the colonies, they were taken for food along with elk and other herbivores prior to that.
So I'm glad you touched upon kind of that almost brink of extinction for this species, because I wanted to ask you about that sort of period of time where these bison were being targeted. So if you could just talk about that a little bit and what that looked like.
With initial colonization, establishment of the colonies, bison were hunted along with all the other animals along the East Coast. But then with westward expansion, more and more animals were taken. It was a market commodity. Their coats were extremely valuable, their hides, because they were really warm. Their meat was utilized, and their tongues, everything was utilized. Post-Civil War, there was an expansion of need for land. The westward expansion railroads are being developed. Large herds of bison that would take days to walk through or go through on horseback got in the way of putting railroads in. And there's a lot of historical references to the reduction in bison as a food for indigenous tribes. very much an intentional approach to remove a food source, and it would be easier to control the indigenous tribes and hopefully then have them go to the reservation. I'm not an expert in this area. These are the stories that I've read up on, but it was a very rapid decline from tens of millions down to 2,500 to 3,000 animals. We don't know the exact numbers. We know the numbers that were in specific herds that were from Texas up into Canada that then kind of acted as the seed stock for restoring bison in Yellowstone and then eventually across the landscape. And those Yellowstone we're talking about as genetically pure bison as possible. There are beefalo that are still out on ranches that was intentional to breed cows and bison to kind of make a tougher cow and a more docile bison and other reasons. Yellowstone bison are as genetically pure as they can be. I think they have a very, very small amount of cattle genes in them, but it dates back to times prior to westward expansion.
I want to ask you about the Yellowstone bison that are currently there today. So I would love for you to tell us about this. I believe there's one herd left. Talk to us about what those bison look like, what they do in the park, and, you know, how do they thrive there?
So it was in the 1930s that the restoration project began. The buffalo ranch and bison buffalo is interchangeable. And they were treated like livestock. They grew hay for them. Hay was planted and put up to feed them in the wintertime. And that's where some of the seed animals from the populations that were from Texas to Canada were brought into the park. And at the same time, it turned out that there were probably 25 animals still residing in the park that it were just not observed. Most of those animals, after a period of time, went down into the central part of the park, down near Old Faithful and the caldera of the volcano that Yellowstone is famous for being. And that established the central herd. And that herd was the largest herd for many years. But in the mid to late 90s, more animals started heading north to the northern range where our paper is focused. And that's along the Lamar Valley that then feeds into the Yellowstone River. There's more productive grasslands there. So there are still animals in the central range, but it's a smaller number. And when we talk about numbers in the paper, we're referring to primarily the northern range numbers, and that's where most of them are. I don't know what the counts were done in late August. I don't know what the latest number is, but it's usually 2/3 to 3/4 are in the northern range, and then the remained are in the northern herd, and the remainder are in the central herd. So there was a big flip-flop. They've done genetic testing. They've demonstrated that there's no genetic difference between the central herd and the northern herd. They are truly one large herd, and that paper came out in the last year. You know, if they were distinct, then managing them differently would be an important thing to consider. But as a whole, they're serving their function in the park, and they're in the central herd. They're grazing grasses in the same way, but they migrate in a slightly different way. They leave the park in the winter and go out towards West Yellowstone. Some of them head north in the winter and go to the same place where the northern herd goes, but they all serve the same role in the park.
How did you conduct your study to see how the bison, you know, changed the soil and even the vegetation of the Yellowstone National Park?
So in 2015, the project actually started as a monitoring project by the Department of Interior funding the Park Service to see what increased numbers of bison were potentially doing to the grasslands. And I was brought in to analyze vegetation and do some soil work. I had been doing some previous soil work with the Park Service grassland restoration. As we were moving along through that, we realized that, you know, we're not just monitoring productivity and is soil organic matter stable and where are we, just kind of the standard metrics, but we had the opportunity to do some cool ecology, right? And test some fundamental things that have been demonstrated primarily in the Serengeti, but also at Kansa with bison in the Great Plains, but we're in the short grass steppe, so it's a slightly different system. But we indeed had migrating animals, relatively free to move. They can't leave the park necessarily, but within the park, they can move where they want to. So the way we did this was we set up fences. So in April, after snowmelt, fences would be set up. We'd have six of those, and there would be fixed enclosures for ungrazed treatments, and they would be up from April to October. And then we had enclosures that were movables, and they moved every 30 days. And that let us know how much biomass was produced in grazed grasslands and get an estimate of how much was removed in that 30 days, because the difference between inside and outside that movable gave us an indication of whether any grazing was taking place. So when we collected that data for biomass, we also did some vegetative assessments, so what plants are present. And then we took soil cores to analyze plant available nitrogen, which is ammonium and nitrate, which is what comes in commercial fertilizers, but also comes from dung and urine. We also looked at organic matter. So the amount of organic matter that's coming from lots of different sources, dung, dead plants, dead insects that are below ground, arthropods, lots of things. And then we also analyzed the microbes, so microbial populations, and looked at nitrogen cycling through some other techniques in the last 3 years of the study. So we kind of built on the early years to then say, okay, we need to explain where the nitrogen is coming from that's showing up in the leaf tissue, and that's where we got into the nitrogen cycling aspects.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. If you're just joining us, we're learning all about bison in Yellowstone National Park with Bill Hamilton, a professor of biology at Washington and Lee University.
Could you tell us about the grazing pattern of the migratory bison? And did the bison improve anything for the soil and vegetation in Yellowstone?
Well, we can kind of start in the winter for the migration pattern. There's not a huge altitude gradient. The lowest is about 5,200 feet, and then up to 9,000 feet at some of the highest ranges in the summer range, and that's what we call it, our high altitude sites. And they really only go down to that lowest altitude in years of really high snowpack. Otherwise, they stay in the paper we call our dry sites, and they're from 5,800 to 6,800 feet. But they tend to be soils that are rocky and drier and support slower growing grass species and forbs, so wildflowers. But they're the first things to green up in the spring. So the animals hit there, they graze on that green grass. Well, the grazing lawns, which are out in the Lamar Valley and on the way out to the Lamar Valley, are still kind of waking up. They're thawing out. They'll calve in that range between the dry and the grazing lawn sites. And the grazing lawn sites are about the same altitude, 6,600 feet. They'll calve, hang out there for a while, and then as the snow melts at higher altitude, they'll move up, go on foraging missions in small groups. But you know, if there's 5,000 bison, they're not moving together. They break off in smaller groups, quite often, you know, familial, maternal relatedness groups. Bulls tend to kind of do their own thing. They'll be off in groups of 5 to 10, and some of them, they'll only really congregate during the breeding season. Younger bulls will hang out with the family, but then they spread out. And then they recongregate down in the grazing lawns for the rut. Right now, they've spread back out again. There's a forecast for snow above 10,000 feet for the next 3 days, so that'll start pushing them down. But it's not until 4 or 5 feet of snow accumulates that bison are really inhibited from using their big hump and their large heads to plow snow and find food in what they call grazing craters. They just go in a group and clear out an area and graze. A freeze thaw will make a crust on the ice, on the snow too, and then they have to move because they look tough, but their noses are still sensitive to getting cut up. So they have to move down and find exposed areas. And that's where those dry sites that are windswept southern exposure, grass grew while they were not there, and they can come back and graze on that until the spring green up.
Do the bison help in terms of their grazing patterns, just these areas, these dry spots that you talk about? Do they help those areas grow quicker, or do they change anything about that soil and vegetation in any way?
Yes. So the process of grazing and then the deposition of dung and urine has positive effects on all of the landscapes, the dry, the grazing lawns, and the high altitude. The biggest effects are in the grazing lawns that we found because it's concentrated aggregate grazing. Their heads are down, they're moving across, and kind of, it's, we call it a grazing lawn because it looks like a mowed lawn. Even though there's still a high degree of heterogeneity, there'll still be grass that's waist deep in that area, but then areas are mowed down to 4 or 5 inches, right? At all of those sites, depending when grazing is taking place, there's a mechanism that I've done some work, I've published some papers and others have, where grazing actually stimulates grasses to exude carbon into the soil. And in doing that, they stimulate decomposition, they prime the pump. And what's being broken down is a lot of the organic matter that has been coming into the system from dung, right? That is more decomposable than a dead leaf tissue because it's been through the digestive system of an animal. And we've been, as a species, we've been using manure as a fertilizer as long as it's been around. So that's not a new result. But that the more grazing that takes place in any one area, you have the plants that are not just passively involved in this process of taking nitrogen from the soil, regrowing and feeding the bison, but they're actually helping propagate their own fertilizer. But then urine is pure nitrogen, it's ammonium fertilizer, and then the dung that's around doesn't accumulate, it makes its way back into the soil to maintain organic matter and allow for decomposition to occur. The stimulation of that varies. The drier sites, there's a shorter period. Because they're dry, they go dormant within 4 to 6 weeks. If there's a little rain in the fall, they'll wake back up again for a bit. And then the high altitude sites, they really get limited by frost. Like they're probably, they've already experienced some frosts and things are shutting down. The plants have gone dormant and the microbes are getting cold in the soil and things slow down. So it's a shorter functional growing season for plants and microbes. Whereas in the grazing lawns, it's a longer period. It's about 150 days that that takes place.
So now that we talked about some of the positives, I want to talk about the possibilities that there's issues or problems that arise from this. If there are, could you explain what those are? And if there's not, why is that?
So there's a paradigm in how we look at livestock grazing versus wildlife grazing. I've straddled both worlds for my whole career. And growing up working on a dairy farm in the Adirondacks with mostly beef cows and some dairy cattle, I understood that the livestock aspect of things. And primarily it comes down to rangeland management approaches, and that's managing on federal land, so BLM, Forest Service land, which out west, 80% of the land is federal land, somewhere in that ballpark. And not all of that can be grazed, but a lot of it can be. And there's a rule of thumb for grazing for cattle or sheep or whatever, horses, of leave 50, take 50. So 50% of the biomass can be grazed, 50% is left behind, 25% of that is soiled and trampled, and the other 25% is left for wildlife and to restore organic matter and litter in the system. When you're thinking about any natural system, which we don't have very many that are intact on Earth, you don't have to manage for that because you're not leaving things behind. So it's a very different perspective. And I'm not saying that Yellowstone is working perfectly because it's such a human impacted system. The fact that there are roads there create problems, right? The fact that there are people there on a daily basis creates problems, but it's a different way of looking at things. The viewpoint for, livestock management is they want to look out and see kind of homogeneity of the species. Everything's been grazed to the same level, and there's kind of a good species mix. And the species mix is not all that different from what we would necessarily find in Yellowstone rangelands if we were looking at federal lands. But when you allow animals to do what they want to do, they're going to graze certain areas more and leave others alone. There are large stretches of grasslands in Yellowstone that still don't get grazed. They make perfectly good grass and other forbs, but the animals are not going there yet. Some years they do, drought years they do, but at a broader scale, there's lots of heterogeneity. We see it at the ground level. You know, in one square acre, we can see really closely cropped grass and also taller grass. But then there are areas that are a full square acre that aren't even grazed, right? So there's extreme heterogeneity at different scales. And that heterogeneity is not just good for bison and other wild grazers, but it creates heterogeneity for songbirds, for nesting, for arthropods, which is a whole nother project we're working on, right? If you have a couple of tall wisps of grass, a spider can make a web, an orb-weaving spider. And there's a whole nother food chain of arthropods that are keying into what bison are doing. That we haven't published that yet, but we're working on it. It's just a different way of looking at things. And the outcome is different. Livestock, we're trying to produce an animal that's going to then produce an economic return. And with the natural systems, we value that. The Park Service was created for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. And people really enjoy seeing bison on the landscape. We need to let them do what they want to do.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Madeline Reynolds. I've been speaking with Bill Hamilton, professor of biology at Washington and Lee University, all about migratory bison in Yellowstone National Park.
For many years, I think several, Native American tribes have sought to restore bison to their lands. Do you think that this is something that can or happen or should happen? And what is the steps and process to make that happen, that restoration process, if that's even a possibility outside of federal land like Yellowstone National Park?
Yeah, so definitely. And what we've demonstrated through science is a belief and an understanding that indigenous tribes have had since before European settlement of North America. Their spiritual and cultural connection cannot be questioned. You know, we've provided the scientific evidence for other folks to say this is important. And bison are doing no harm in the park and actually doing good things because they're improving the quality of food. 2018 was the first year where Yellowstone bison entered into the Bison Conservation Transfer Program, where they're transferred to the Fort Peck Reservation, which is the Assiniboine Sioux Reservation up in central north Montana, to the east of Glacier. Those are brucellosis-free animals. And brucellosis, it's a disease that creates the conflict between ranchers and the Park Service. Elk and bison carry it. It causes the loss of calves in both bison, elk, and cattle, but it's a bigger deal for cattle ranchers. It's a valid concern, but what the park has done is they have a quarantine facility, the low elevation sites. Young animals are tested for brucellosis. If they maintain their brucellosis-free status, if they're bulls, they get transferred sooner than cows. Cows have to give birth to a brucellosis-free calf. Once they do that, they transfer them to Fort Peck, and those animals then enter into the Intertribal Buffalo Council. They stay at Fort Peck for an additional quarantine period, and then the ITBC transfers them across the members of that group with the hopes of getting them across the landscape in small numbers, but maybe larger numbers as well because of the spiritual and cultural connectedness of bison to numerous, I can't think of the numbers of tribes. And there's 49 confirmed indigenous tribes that have associations with Yellowstone alone. But that doesn't count all the ones in the plains that had connections to bison as well. So we're just scratching the surface, but that program is helping with that.
Do you think bison can thrive outside of Yellowstone National Park? Is there even a chance or a way for them to maybe even repopulate? So I'm just wondering if there's a way to do that or if that's even possible with modern day society.
Yes. And I mean, the main thing is, nobody wants to run into a bison. Bad enough to run into a white-tailed deer and then an elk and then a moose. Nobody wants to run into a 2,000-pound bison. And their eyes don't reflect headlights at night. So you have this large brown animal on a highway and you don't see the reflections. It's difficult. But I think we could get more on the landscape, and the perspective needs to be many of the current conservation herds that are either in indigenous tribal hands or in federal herds, they need to be treated less like cattle and more like wildlife, and maybe seeing how many they can be supported. There's nothing wrong with the approach that's been taken of saying this land can support this many animals, but it could be that it could support more. But there would need to be a tolerance for seeing things differently than the rangeland perspective. The American Prairie Reserve in Montana is putting together acreage, tribal lands, private lands, federal lands, securing the grazing rights if it's federal land, getting permission from tribal lands, and hoping to increase, and it's close to 3 million acres they'd like to put together, and upwards of 10,000 bison. This is a big vision, a big plan to get bison moving across the Montana landscape, which would be incredible. There's a lot of potential there. There are other federal grasslands, Colorado, further south, where larger herds could exist, but there'd have to be tolerance, right? And we've seen that tolerance to some extent with wolves, right? They were reintroduced in the park, and there's still a conflict-related animal. People are still upset about it, but there's a tolerance there. They're not as big, but they kill livestock. If there's a will, there's a way. And I think that we could get more of them out of the landscape and not have to manage them as heavily as some of the herds currently are, where it's no more than 1,000. And after 1,000, we have to send them. And quite often they get sent off to go to other tribes. They're not slaughtered for food, but they don't stay in that landscape. They go to another place.
Thinking about your research, all of it that you've done and studied, what do you think, to you, did you find the most fascinating aspect of it all?
Actually, well, the result that I haven't even talked about is was the incredible increase across the landscape in crude protein. So leaf nitrogen was elevated by the stimulation of the nitrogen cycle and the plants taking it up, and that was higher in grazing, right? But it was almost a doubling in the amount, the millions of kilograms of crude protein across the grasslands of Yellowstone. It was 3.4 versus 6.7 million kilograms increased of crude protein. And crude protein is what animals are queuing in on. And that was just from, you know, looking at areas that have been excluded for a year, right? We just took out grazers for a year. So if you expand that and say, what would it, you know, if we removed grazing for 10 years, I would predict it would be an even bigger effect. And that's a future experiment that we'd like to investigate, is what are the longer term effects of removing bison grazing and other grazing for longer periods of time? Because that was just 1 year, and we see this incredible effect of these large animals moving freely and grazing the way they do. You know, when that calculation came out, you know, using satellite data with our ground truth data and scaling it up across the northern range, it was just it's a huge number. We didn't test this in the paper, but the quality of the grass and the forbs that are there, it's not just benefiting bison. All the animals that are eating it benefiting from that improved grassland. That's a future study to look at the facilitation that might be taking place.
This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1824. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Madeline Reynolds.